Okay, good afternoon, everybody. My name is John Adams. I'm the president of the Chicago Lawyers Federalist Society. I'm an attorney here in Chicago, practicing civil and commercial litigation at Eimer Stahl. Today marks another event in which we, the Federalist Society of Chicago, enter a brave new world. Whereas in past months, we've explored the seemingly upside-down world of the pandemic and the status of our Constitution, or a seismic shift in the application of our antitrust laws to big tech. This afternoon, we venture into the novel space of digital assets. So what are digital assets? Who uses them? Should countries like El Salvador endorse them? How do we use them? What are the legal ramifications for classifying and using digital assets? How do we make money with digital assets? How do we make lots of money with digital assets? As these questions lay bare, perhaps we could think about digital assets in one of two ways. One, their classification, and two, their use. Of course, these two broad buckets could in no way describe all the nuances and complexities that accompany digital assets and that we'll need to sort out over the next hour. So let's get to it. Here with us is an exciting panel of experts and practitioners who will help us think through these questions while overlaying current industry and regulatory developments. And I'll begin by introducing the panelists just as they appear on my screen. First, we have Mr. Jeff Carter. Mr. Carter was an integral member of a small group at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange that revolutionized capital markets in the late 1990s. He went on to start Hyde Park Angels in Chicago, one of the most active angel capital organizations in the world. That organization jump-started the Chicago startup ecosystem. As an individual and as a general partner at West Loop Ventures, he has invested in cryptocurrency and cryptocurrency-focused companies. He currently lives in Las Vegas, Nevada. Next, Mr. Dan Davis. Mr. Davis is a partner in Catton's Financial Markets and Funds Practice. Prior to joining Catton, Dan served with distinction for 4 years as the general counsel of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. We're very honored to have Mr. Davis with us today. Next on my screen, Mr. James Koudelis. Mr. Koudelis is the CEO of Typhon Capital Management, a deconstructed multi-strat that includes the award-winning Leadenitis Cryptocurrency Fund. While running Typhon, he was also a lead customer counsel in the MF Global Bankruptcy and led recovery of 101 cents on the dollar of a $6.7 billion in client assets, all pro bono. He also worked with Mr. Doherty, who we'll introduce here momentarily, on one of the first major complement token pre-funding rounds, which raised $133 million at a $1 billion valuation. And I love the Greek themes throughout his life and his tenure here. Mr. Matt Lyle is next. Mr. Lyle has almost 30 years experience as a practicing lawyer, most of it practicing in commodities future industry in a variety of roles. Lately, he has been immersed in the world of crypto, serving as a partner and general counsel for crypto lending and investment management, which was recently acquired by Galaxy Digital. And according to Mr. Lyle, nobody can truly call himself an expert in this field, but I think our audience might beg to differ at the end of this presentation. He still spends his time guessing a lot as to what is compliant activity in the world of crypto, which has kept him young at heart. To address the legal uncertainties in this area, he's a founding member and current board chairman of the Global Digital Asset and Cryptocurrency Association, which we hope to hear more about. Next, we have our dear friend of the Federalist Society, Professor John McGinnis. Professor McGinnis is the George C. Dix Professor of Constitutional Law at Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. He is a distinguished scholar of constitutional law, antitrust, and has also written prolifically on digital assets. And we look forward to his remarks as he explores the scholarship of digital assets and the history. And finally, another wonderful friend of the Federalist Society, Patrick Doherty. Mr. Doherty joined the Federalist Society as a young lawyer working in President Ronald Reagan's Securities and Exchange Commission. He is a graduate of Cornell Law School, and today he heads the digital assets practice at Foley & Lardner and lectures on digital assets when invited to speak, which I'm sure he's often invited to speak, at Northwestern and IIT. He is also a member of our advisory council, the Chicago Lawyers chapter, and we appreciate all of the advice and counsel he has done, including organizing this wonderful event. Mr. Doherty, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you for the very warm introduction, John. And we can't acknowledge everyone who's in the audience, but I do want to particularly welcome the students of Sam Tenenbaum from his class on investor protection. It's Investor Protection Clinic at Northwestern Pritzker, who I have been invited to this program and I believe have dialed in. Go Cats. There's so much to cover. I'm just going to set the stage a little bit by explaining how far we've come in the last 3 years. And I choose that time period because nearly this same panel 3 years ago spoke on these topics at the University Club in Chicago. Here we are doing it virtually 3 years later. So, you know, what's happened in the last 3 years? Well, I'll begin with Bitcoin prices. It reached a high of $20,000, nearly $20,000 at the end of 17. And at that time, you may remember, all the normies in our lives were saying crypto is a fraud, it's a scam, it's going to go to zero tomorrow, it's worthless. Well, in 2018, the price did go to the low 3,000. And at that time, the same skeptics were saying, you know, told you so, crypto is worthless. So bring it forward a couple of years. It's January of 21, and the price has gone past 30,000. Now the normies say, well, maybe it's not worthless, but it's surely volatile. Okay, noted, volatile. A month later, it's past $50,000. Mid-April, $64,000 a Bitcoin. More than three times what it was when it was declared to be worthless. Today, I'm looking online at my account, which didn't exist 3 years ago, $55,000. Not bad for a worthless asset. Same story with Ether and others. How far that has come. Look at who is investing in trading this product today, who was not doing it 3 years ago. How about Paul Tudor Jones, probably the most acclaimed of all hedge fund managers of all time. Cathie Wood, who manages ARK Invest, probably the most notable mutual fund out of the thousands of mutual funds in existence. Elon Musk, we know. Mark Cuban, we know. Virtually every major university endowment in the United States has exposure to digital assets. That didn't exist 3 years ago. Those aren't stupid people. And of course, the OGs just keep on going. I won't name them. Corporate America has gotten involved. MicroStrategy, Michael Saylor's data analytics firm, started buying Bitcoin for its treasury in 2020 and now holds more than $5 billion worth of Bitcoin on its treasury balance sheet at a cost, by the way, of less than $3 billion. That's been a good trade. That's for their treasury, mind you. Tesla owns a hoard of Bitcoin. Square, Jack Dorsey's payments company, owns it. Mass Mutual, the insurance company, very conservative institution, bought $100 million worth of Bitcoin for its general account. There have been these IPOs, Coinbase, we know about this past April, Robinhood, just 2 months ago. Robinhood's reported that crypto accounts for more than half of its sales. Think about that. More than half of its sales in crypto. Some people have had to eat crow. Jamie Dimon famously called crypto assets a fraud and then threatened to fire any JP Morgan trader who traded crypto assets. Today, that was 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Today, JP Morgan sells JPM coin and it sponsors an actively managed Bitcoin fund for its customers. Goldman Sachs set up a crypto desk, then shut it down. And then they found they had better stand it up again. So they did. The SEC rejected about a dozen Bitcoin ETF applicants, but now seems to be getting ready to approve a Bitcoin ETF based on futures contracts that trade on the CMA right here in Chicago. So, it's come so far, so fast, and You know, I like to say Bitcoin, not dead yet. Crypto assets, not dead yet. This has become 100% of my law practice. John McGinnis says, a scholar with very broad tastes and fields of study, including constitutional law, but he took an interest in this early on. And I think I'm going to turn it over to John now, because I think he's going to share with us his current thinking on the, you know, the economics, the philosophy, the monetary policy, and the many social science fields that are involved in crypto assets. John, talk to us about that, would you?
Well, thank you so much, Pat. I'm going to talk about the nature of Bitcoin and put it in a somewhat put it in a broad perspective of what it's trying to do. I think it's useful to begin with a discussion of Bitcoin. It's the granddaddy of digital assets. It remains by far the highest market cap of digital assets, and I think its ambitions are the greatest. So I'm going to try to put it in the context of its ambitions, which is nothing less than to become a currency. Now, I'd want to note that I've been a member of the Federalist Society for over 3 decades. And when I began, it would be unimaginable that we would be talking about cryptocurrency rather than the separation of powers or the rule of law. But ultimately, the society is concerned, and the Constitution it celebrates, are concerned with the relation of liberty and the state. And I don't think there's any issue of modern technology, therefore, more appropriate to consider for the Federalist Society than cryptocurrency, because it's on the dividing edge between liberty and the state, between a decentralized coercive order on the one hand and a decentralized voluntary one on the other. And that divide comes here in the most important matter of all, money. So let's contrast Bitcoin with modern fiat currency, like the dollars in your pocket, in your bank account. That's quintessentially a creature of the state. In 1924, George Frederick Knapp, a German theorist and the father of modern monetary theory, wrote, "The soul of the currency is not in the material of the pieces, but in the legal ordinances that regulate their use." Knapp argued the currency must be constituted by public law, since only government could confer the requisite legitimacy to gain acceptance and public trust. Thus, underlying the value of a fiat currency, it's intrinsically tied to a public's trust in that legal system. Of course, some citizens have little trust in their legal system, particularly when it comes to currency. Nation states can manipulate their currency, printing more money to fund projects for their favorite supporters. Savings then lose their value as prices are driven up by inflation. Citizens become less certain of money as a store of value, and economic growth suffers. Government control over money thus can be a form of oppression, no less than a denial of civil liberties. Because, for instance, of hyperinflation today, Venezuela is about the most extreme example of what I would call a monetarily oppressive regime. The recent advent of cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin chief among them, poses a practical challenge to such monetarily oppressive regimes, but it also poses a theoretical challenge to the view of Knapp that the public law of currency is a necessary foundation of money. Bitcoin does not require faith in any public institution, such as the Federal Reserve, a monarch, or any other central authority, but rather trust in the computer logic and the effectiveness of a decentralized order that maintains it. This Bitcoin is nothing less than a fundamental assault on the idea that a public law of currency is a necessary prerequisite of the modern monetary order. The basic it aims at an Achilles heel of that order, because the basic problem for fiat or public currency is that a legal system can't generally make the pre-commitment necessary to completely isolate the governance of money from all political pressure. Bluntly, no one can insulate the stability claimed by public law from the hurly-burly of politics. Now, to be sure, I'm not here to bash the Fed. The US dollar is the world's most trusted currency. Despite its many critics, it's formed the basis for 90% of international trade over the last 30 years. Yet the dollar has been subject to periods of severe and unexpected inflation. In fact, since the creation of the Federal Reserve, the purchasing power of the dollar has fallen 97%. And that's not a surprise. Since the Progressive Era, the Federal Reserve has had by law other political objectives than maintaining the value of the currency, such as getting to full employment. But individuals have only one desire for a currency, that it maintain or increase its value. The basic divergence between the social objectives of fiat money and the individual's objective of maintaining value is what necessarily limits the trust that any fiat currency can enjoy. It is what offers the opportunity for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin to play an extraordinarily important role. So I want to be clear, while Bitcoin may function as a currency in Venezuela now because it's more trustworthy than their currency, it does not function as a currency in more established regimes like the United States. Of course, that doesn't mean people don't hold it here. Some do, but even most of those who do hold it only for small investments and use it to pay for a few items, often as a kind of hobby. And the vast majority of us hold most of our investments in dollar-denominated assets, use cash to pay day-to-day expenses. And what's the reason for that? For most people, Bitcoin is not yet enough good store of value. It's simply too volatile compared to the dollar, and risk-averse people don't want to hold their cash or assets in assets that's so volatile that it may dissipate or may change value substantially overnight. So I want to conclude by focusing on what it's going to take for Bitcoin to become something more, even more widely held. And to be more successful and widely used, I think Bitcoin, it's important to understand that it doesn't need to become less volatile and more accepted than the dollar immediately. There are many less successful currencies against which it could compete, and it would gain much value simply by replacing or even complementing gold as the basic hedge fund against currency devaluation. And that gives it an enormous range of ability to grow. Gold is still has value around 14 times as much as the total value of Bitcoin. And there are two important conditions, I think, to facilitate this development. I think that's important to consider as we look at regulation. First, there have to be monetarily oppressive regimes so as to give substantial impetus to the use of Bitcoin as an alternate currency. Now, I'm not too worried about that condition. Given the renewed enthusiasm for socialism throughout the world, this condition is already being satisfied. When socialists run out of other people's money, they print more of it for themselves, and that gives an opportunity for cryptocurrency. The second condition for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies to be more successful as a stable store of value is more open-ended. There has to be continued strength in what I would call the cryptocurrency ecosystem. Most people don't have the skills to use Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies directly. There are amusing, well, maybe the more sad than amusing stories about people who somehow lost their Bitcoin key and looking for it in their papers or looking for it in a garbage dump. Bitcoin owners need to keep an open key wallet. They need mechanisms to ensure the security of dealings with Bitcoin. They need cryptocurrency wallets and exchanges. Fortunately, these institutions have gotten better over time since the day Mt. Gox lost hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin. And the market is likely to deliver us better ecosystem for cryptocurrency. Even more importantly, there needs to be continued growth around markets around Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency. Futures and forward markets make the price discovery process for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies more efficient. They help dampen volatility. Permitting funds that invest in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies will allow more people to hold Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies as part of their portfolio. That will also thicken the market and have a stabilizing effect. Now note that these wallets, future markets, and investment funds, they're not order without law. They are institutions regulated by our law, by our administrators, by the CFTC, by the SEC. Thus, paradoxically, I want to end on this note that it's a clear paradox. The success of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies may depend, does depend, on the state's willingness to apply neutral principles of law to the ecosystem surrounding an innovation that may itself turn out to be a competitor to one of the greatest powers of the state, its ability to print fiat money. That shows, I think, why cryptocurrency, far from being just a technological innovation, as interesting as that innovation is a central question for the rule of law and our constitutional protections for property, and therefore is in the wheelhouse of the Federalist Society, as well as all those cryptocurrency enthusiasts out there today. Thanks very much.
Professor, thank you very much for your thoughts. We will address some of these points throughout the program and come back to you. I should have mentioned earlier, we can take questions from the audience. I think we'll collect them, but there's a Q&A function here, a bar somewhere on your screen, so that you can, if you have questions or comments, feel free to make them, and we'll try to pull them and get to them toward the end of this hour and a half. I'd like to turn to Dan Davis in or near Washington, who had several important federal appointments, but most recently as general counsel of the CFTC, one of the agencies that primarily charged with some degree of regulation over this field. I think Dan is going to speak to us about what the CFTC is doing, certainly, but also the SEC. And if time permits, maybe also the Treasury Department, because we do have all these agencies that have some role in the regulation of these digital assets. Dan, please share.
Thanks, Pat. And thank you to the Federal Society for inviting me back. I'm in Northern Virginia right now, but I went to law school in Chicago and very much enjoyed the event we had 3 years ago. And was very excited to be invited back, and it's good to be here again. As Pat mentioned, I was general counsel from 2017 to 2021. When I joined in March 2017, the price of Bitcoin was $1,100. So it was even lower than, you know, 3 years ago when we had our last event. 2017 was a big year for Bitcoin at the CFTC. It's where it really kind of got on the radar screen. That at the end of that year, the first futures contracts for Bitcoin were listed. And as Professor McGinnis alluded to, you know, the futures and forward contracts in those markets have a lot of beneficial effects for all of the underlining. But with respect to Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, in one sense, it gave a way to short cryptocurrencies, and it gave a way to give better price discovery of cryptocurrencies. And there's been suggestions that at least some of the effects of the futures market in Bitcoin in 2018 and some of the moderation and kind of repricing of Bitcoin was impacted significantly by the input of the futures markets. And so that's always been, it's been a very important part of my role as general counsel. I went into that role thinking I was going to be working only on futures and derivatives. I ended up spending an enormous amount of my time on crypto. And ever since coming into private practice like Pat, an enormous amount of my practice is devoted to crypto. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the regulatory environment that we find ourselves with cryptocurrency. And it's complicated, and I could spend all day on it, but I'll kind of try and hit a couple of key points. I think kind of an overarching theme is, you know, when you're talking about the CFTC or the SEC or the Treasury, all of these agencies are working with statutory provisions and statutory schemes that predate and did not anticipate cryptocurrency. And so there's really very few laws or regulations on the books that explicitly address digital assets. And so this is, but in one sense, that's not new to the agencies. You know, the CFTC has dealt with all sorts of variations of futures and derivatives products that they've dealt with over time. But the initial instinct of any agency is to try to understand how a new product or a new asset class works with their particular regulatory scheme and their regulation set, and to see how well it mixes, and to see if Congress is going to do anything that to change that regulatory set. And you're seeing that, you've been seeing that playing out over the past few years with the agency. Yesterday, Chair Gensler of the SEC had a hearing before the House Financial Services Committee. And though I didn't have a clock to time him, I think that he spent more time on crypto-related questions than any other subject. I think that there's no way that would have happened 3 years ago. And I think, as Pat alluded to, that reflects the growth, relevance, importance, and significance of the cryptocurrency market. Now, Chair Gensler and the SEC has an important role with respect to cryptocurrency, because one of the major gateway questions that people are asking is a particular cryptocurrency a security or a non-security? And that primarily depending on what type of cryptocurrency and what type of asset you're dealing with, that usually turns on whether something is either an investment contract or an asset or a note under the securities laws. You know, investment contract is governed primarily by the Howey test, which is many, many decades old. And whether something is a note is governed by the Reeves test, which was a 1990 Supreme Court decision. And so there's a whole episode that we could do about Howey and Reeves and what they mean and how they play, but that's where a lot of the playground is in the SEC. Chair Gensler has taken a very broad view of what those tests mean and how they apply. You know, the SEC under Chairman Clayton, or the staff at least, had made statements alluding to the fact that they thought Bitcoin and Ether were probably not securities. There's a famous speech by Director Hinman saying that Ether may have been a security when it first came out, but we think it's morphed into a non-security. Yesterday at the House Financial Committee hearing, Chair Gensler was not willing to say whether Bitcoin or Ether was not a security. And he's talked in the past in a number of his statements how he thinks a lot of these things are securities and should be regulated under the securities laws. That view is obviously a very disputed one. And there are a lot of people who disagree with that view. And I think that's going to play out over time. A couple of key things to look there. First is the XRP litigation. That's a suit that was brought last year by the SEC against Ripple and the XRP token. The SEC claims that XRP has been and currently is a security and that should have been registered under the securities laws. Ripple has brought a very active defense against the SEC's claims. And that's going to be a very important case to watch. You know, there's always a possibility that the case will settle. But if that case goes to conclusion and you get a decision, I think that will give a lot of information about what sits on what side of the line on the Howey test with respect to a number of these tokens. Now, you're also looking for additional regulatory clarity. Commissioner Peirce from the SEC has put out a proposed safe harbor for cryptocurrencies, basically a three-year period for a cryptocurrency to get up and running and try to get decentralized enough that it doesn't, you know, meet the Howey test. That obviously hasn't been adopted by the commission, but it's something that she's put out, and it's something that people in Congress have looked at and are interested in, and a number of proposals have been put out regarding that. And so I think you're going to see a lot of activity in the SEC here regarding crypto. An interesting move that was just recently announced by the SEC is that they are hiring Dan Berkovitz to be the general counsel of the SEC. I know Dan Berkovitz very well. He currently is a commissioner at the CFTC, where he'll conclude his service next week, and he'll join the SEC's general counsel in November. Commissioner Berkovitz worked on the Hill for a number of years, and he used to hold my position at the CFTC. He used to be general counsel, working for Chair Gensler when he was chair of the CFTC. I think that's an important thing to watch, because Commissioner Berkovitz is very knowledgeable about the futures and derivative space. He's done a lot of work in the crypto space. He understands Chair Gensler very well, and he's expressed a lot of interest in a lot of areas of cryptocurrency, including DeFi. decentralized finance. I think this is going to be an interesting area to watch. Commissioner Berkovitz made a speech a couple of months ago where he expressed a lot of concern about DeFi and how it interacts with the CFTC space. I think as Professor McGinnis alluded to, you know, decentralized finance, its proponents really kind of talk about the lack of need for governance and the lack of need for the traditional intermediaries and players that I think the SEC and the CFTC are used to interacting with, and the rule set was designed to address. Commissioner Berkovitz in his speech talked about potential ways that if a DeFi platform is dealing in products that are deemed to be futures or swaps, that it will need to be registered under the CFTC's rules and regulations, which itself could create some complications. You know, Chair Gensler himself has talked a lot about DeFi, expressed a lot of concerns about DeFi and what kind of investor protections it offers, because that's, you know, obviously something that the SEC cares a lot about. And I think, you know, the SEC has brought a couple of cases against DeFi platforms. I think some people would say those really weren't DeFi platforms. They were probably on their way to be DeFi, but had a number of aspects of centralized control that really make them decentralized in name only. But I think it's clear that the SEC and CFTC are asking a lot of questions and engaging a lot of investigative activity here. And I think you're going to see more enforcement activity, unfortunately, in this spot. The agencies have been criticized a lot for engaging in regulation by enforcement. I think there's a lot to say about that criticism. I think the regulation by enforcement is going to continue for some degree. And I think it's an open question is how much the agencies are going to engage in, you know, providing guidance and additional clarification about what they think various aspects of their rule sets mean. The CFTC last year issued a guidance regarding actual delivery, which is a term that's relevant to futures and retail commodity transaction products that have a leverage or a margin respect to them. People have criticized that interpretation, but it is an interpretation that gives at least more clarification about how the CFTC views one aspect of the rule set. And I think that agencies would do well to engage in more activity on that path. And it behooves the digital asset industry to actively engage with the agencies on the rulemaking front and to encourage give them good information so they understand how these products worked and the amount of variation and what, you know, rules could be useful and provide that type of guidance. The CFTC has done a couple of other things. They brought a big case along with, FinCEN against BitMEX, which was an exchange that does work worldwide. That suit was settled with the company. There's a couple of individual suits that are still pending, but it was settled with FinCEN and the CFTC earlier this year for $100 million. BitMEX agreed that it would not engage with U.S. persons because the CFTC alleged that it should have registered as something called a futures commission merchant, which is a CFTC registrant that it can engage in futures and other types of trading. And the FinCEN brought action against BitMEX because it wasn't engaging in proper anti-money laundering and know your customer activity and not, you know, reviewing people to see if they were on improper OFAC sanctions lists. So that was a big case that sent, no pun intended, a ripple through the industry and made a lot of people take a look at, you know, how much are we going to engage with US? What kind of rules do we need in place? What kind of registrations do we need to have in place with respect to, exchanges and, you know, futures commissions merchant? Last week, the CFTC brought 14 cases against entities that they said should have been registered as futures commissions merchants for engaging in binary options trades regarding Bitcoin. It was interesting to me that the orders only mentioned Bitcoin as a cryptocurrency, didn't mention Ether or Litecoin. The BitMEX complaint a year ago did mention Bitcoin and Ether and Litecoin. The CFTC actions taken last week did not mention Ether and Litecoin. I don't know exactly what to make of that, but that's something to keep track of. It was interesting. Another settlement that the CFTC had with another alleged entity that should have registered as an FCM. There was a settlement, where a fine was paid. Commissioner Stump from the CFTC issued a concurring opinion saying, look, I agree, they should have been registered as an FCM. The problem was, is if they had done what we told them and they had registered as an FCM, there still would be problems in our rule set that wouldn't have allowed them to trade the things that they wanted to trade. And so she emphasized that as a problem with the CFTC rule set that the agency needed to deal with. And so I think there's an enormous amount of activity in the SEC and the CFTC right now, and that's going to continue. Very quickly on Treasury, Treasury's been talking a lot about stable coins. There's expected to be Treasury reports coming out in the near future about the stablecoin market and how the federal government is thinking about stablecoins and ways that stablecoins may be regulated. Agencies and Treasury is very focused on ransomware payments. They're very concerned about how crypto is being used for illicit activity. They've gone so far as to list a Russian crypto exchange on the OFAC sanctions list, because in their view, there was so much illicit activity going on there. So that's kind of a quick tour of what's going on with the agencies. It's going to continue to be an active place. And it's going to continue to be a place where people in the digital asset industry really need to recognize that there needs to be engagement with these regulators and to help educate them and to help develop policies so that the rule sets that they have can interact, productively and effectively with, the many variations of digital assets that we continue to see.
Dan, that's quite a tour de force. Thank you. Much appreciated. The questions are starting to come in, and we'll get to a couple later, but I want to ask you one myself. I'm a little bit flummoxed by Chair Gensler refusing to commit about Bitcoin and Ether. I'm flummoxed for two reasons. One is that futures on both of those assets trade on the CME, and it is unlawful for the CME or any futures exchange to trade futures on securities. The SEC had opportunities to object to trading those futures, and it did not. So how can it possibly say this late in the game, well, those are actually securities after all? And I guess related to that question, that's the legal one, is the practical one. Let's just suppose for a minute that the SEC took the view that Bitcoin is a security. Bitcoin yesterday had a market cap that surpassed Facebook. Think about that, by the way. Bitcoin's market cap, which is supposed to be worth zero, according to everyone in 2017, is now greater than Facebook's. If trading in Bitcoin were securities, what would happen? And wouldn't a whole lot of investors get hurt pretty badly by that? And isn't that exactly the opposite of what the federal government is supposed to do?
So a lot of good questions there, Pat. First, on the futures on the CFTC SEC, under the CFTC rule set, the CFTC can object to futures if it's not based on a commodity. And clearly, the CFTC has for several years had the view that Bitcoin and then Ether satisfies the commodity definition, and they're comfortable enough that it's not a security that they feel comfortable doing that. Now, as you will suspect, the CFTC and SEC don't always see 100% eye to eye. Clearly the SEC can change its mind. And I guess in theory, the CFTC could as well. But these are, especially with the development of the futures markets and the development of, really kind of a lot of maturation in those markets, it would be an enormous disruption if Chair Gensler took the view that, not only was Bitcoin a security, but would take an effort to bring an enforcement action against it or somehow bring it within the SEC's purview. And to your practical question, I guess I'd point to the Ripple XRP litigation. It's a smaller than Bitcoin, but still, very large itself. The announcement of the SEC suit, a little over a year ago, had a significant impact on the way that token was traded. It had a big impact on investors, and it had a big impact on the market. You know, a lot of exchanges, refused to trade XRP. And it really kind of did a lot of disruption there. And you kind of see that in the litigation. This past week, the judge allowed a number of XRP holders to join as an amicus to express their views regarding the case. And Chair Gensler got some questions about that very topic yesterday. I forget who the representative was that asked, but he got questions about, are you really helping out investors if an SEC, statement or activity or enforcement action does all this harm to the people who are holding that particular token? And I think those are all very fair questions that the SEC should have to wrestle with as it considers how to, regulate and interact with these, with these products.
I'm glad we have you in Washington to report on these things. Thank you so much. We could talk all day about it, but I think I want to get to some of the business aspects of this industry as well. And we got a couple of folks here who have been deep into it. We start with James Koutoulis. James, James has played many roles here. And I hope that the young lawyers listening in and the law students heard the part about how James pro bono return, what was it, $6 billion, James, something like that, to the investor?
6.7, but who's counting?
Yeah, there you go, pro bono. And that was, here's the part I like, that was, how many lawsuits had you waged before you took that one on pro bono as a lawyer? How many had you waged?
Well, I sort of helped my golf pro with an $8,000 collection case. So I can't really say a zero, but
But there you go. Right out of Northwestern Law School, by the way. And but in addition to that sort of work, James also is a multi-strat hedge fund manager and an investor. So tell us, what you're seeing, in digital asset fund management. John McGinnis said it'd be great to have more funds because it creates a thicker market and has the potential to dampen volatility. What, talk about that. And also, if you would, share your experience in civil litigation in this industry a little bit, because I know you've teamed sometimes with Professor Tenenbaum and sometimes had other matters, with respect to digital asset promoters in the industry. Clue us in. What kind of cases you're seeing and
sure.
should be brought in? What about? Well,
can we flip around? Can we start with number two?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Well, because Dan just really teed me up for a couple of points I'd like to make. So, if you talk about the regulators and the guidance or lack thereof in the space, they've really kind of set up the whole industry in a perverse way, right? So, at its core, blockchain, crypto, it's all about decentralization. Trustless authentication. So to the boomers in the room, that means that the authentication is so good because you're not trusting like one particular company. Like you're not just logging into Facebook, you're logging into thousands of nodes, which all require different encryption keys to verify a single transaction, right? So you have all this promise of this decentralization where you don't have to trust anybody, but because as Dan said, that in the US, we have really regulated by enforcement. And the next step is that enforcement has been overwhelmingly late and slaps on the wrist. You see so many of the market leaders in the space be just outright scumbags who willfully violate securities laws. And one speech that I really liked in particular that I know Pat and I talked about, if I recall, it was back in 2018 when John Clayton called upon us as lawyers, fund administrators, the gatekeepers, the professionals, to basically be the adults in the room and keep the, more entrepreneurial would-be disruptors who have now really at this point acted like how Uber did, breaking taxi laws to get dominance in rideshare. Pat and I remember, were very skeptical that the SEC would let, VCs fund these crypto projects that would just disrupt, SEC laws, since, the VCs aren't really used to dealing with regulated businesses, but they have, right? Yeah. So, And I think it's a disgrace. I think it's a disgrace that there haven't been malpractice suits taken against attorneys. You know, Marco Santori is the GC. It's a major crypto company. I forgot what which one, but you know, he's generally credited with creating the SAF, the Simple Agreement for Future Tokens. Absolute willful violation of every major securities law. Like, that guy shouldn't have a law license. Okay, not to single him out. There's a lot of other, you know, lawyers who, you know, have, in my opinion, breached ethical rules in their fiduciary duties. But there's been zero accountability for the legal profession for doing that. And, you know, you mentioned Sam and I, you know, doing litigation. I mean, we did one arbitration case on behalf of a friend of mine who is incredibly sophisticated in crypto, but got sucked into, you know, a fraud, right? Even like the most sophisticated people in crypto have been victims of frauds. But you look at, you know, another major case Sam and I are doing, we're lead counsel, part of the lead counsel group in the Block One securities fraud class action, where, you know, these guys with support from Peter Thiel, you know, Alan Howard, Lewis Bacon, you know, three hedge fund billionaires, you know, went out, pitched an offering, telling people that they were going to get 1,000%, you know, return on investments, that they were going to make this Bitcoin killer blockchain that was fully decentralized. They did the bare minimum work on the project. You know, the EOS blockchain is basically fully controlled by Chinese oligarchs, right? And instead of investing the proceeds in their year-long ICO into EOS and developing the EOS blockchain and EOS applications, they just said in their offering documents, which, by the way, weren't filed with the SEC and no Form D was filed and were not exempt from registration. So, you know, per the SEC's ridiculous $23 million fine for, you know, under a cease and desist settlement order, you know, they were fined $23 million for raising $4 billion in an illegal ICO, which they then took and bought 180,000 Bitcoin for their own benefit, which are now worth about $13 billion, which they're now trying to SPAC into a public exchange called Bullish. Like, you regulators out there, anyone listening, like, you say you're serious about protecting investors, don't let this SPAC happen. I mean, these guys are outright criminals. You know, I don't understand why they're not in jail right now. So, you know, make it happen. But, you know, the SEC is out there trying to protect retail, ostensibly, you know, from investing in crypto. They just allowed like 5% of mutual funds to go into like the CFTC Bitcoin futures or like GBTC. Give me a break, okay? Like, you know, these guys, retail can go on their phone and buy this stuff on Coinbase, but they can't go to their wealth manager, the RIA that they're paying, and ask for advice. Like, that's not allowed right now, okay? They're not allowed, you know, to have any kind of, you know, crypto security, but you're gonna let Peter Thiel and co. make $13 billion when they lied through their teeth about what the use of proceeds was gonna go in an illegal ICO? Give me a break. So anyway, this has led to this dichotomy where this trustless, super secure technology is being used by criminals to make billions of dollars while they get fractional slaps on the wrist. And, you know, it's disgusting. So, you know, I believe in the technology. You know, we have a crypto fund that is very different than almost every other crypto fund out there. It's run by George Michalopoulos, who is head of energy derivatives at Citadel. I made nine figures for Citadel and P&L in energy in 2008, which is the most competitive volatile asset class. You know, we are of a view that Bitcoin is a commodity, right? And the commodity trading strategies translate really, really well to Bitcoin, and that it's a supply constrained asset that's extremely volatile. But unlike energy, you have all sorts of, you know, retail money in there. You know, so trading strategies, especially the ones that we use that combine both owning digital assets with listed derivatives, such as options on Bitcoin futures or ETH futures, allow us to put, you know, we've generated risk-adjusted returns many multiples of, you know, some of the best traditional hedge funds out there. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future returns, I should probably say. But there's a massive amount of opportunity in this space by taking a non-religious view. I'm also really against all the pumpers out there. you know, I won't, there I won't name names, because I actually like a couple of them. But you have people who, it's like every day, all they talk about is, you got to HODL Bitcoin, you got to pump Solana today. There's so much pump and dump in the space. Like, look at NFTs, you know, with all the self-dealing and kind of consortiums of people who are like, you know, propping up a fake multi-million dollar market for ridiculous JPEGs that don't have anything remotely supply constrained about them. You know, so look, I think buyer beware, caveat emptor, is really important in this space because it is so lightly regulated. But given the immense promise of the technology, if the regulators really wanted to protect people, they'd say buyer beware. But if these issuers commit fraud, they violate the securities laws, they're going to see real civil penalties and criminal enforcement. And that's something that's really been missing from our entire financial system, going back to 2008 when DOJ lost the Bear Stearns case. I think it's Jesse Eisinger wrote the Chicken Shit Club about that. But, you know, we need real enforcement in this country. And the situation we have now is kind of the worst of all worlds. And it promotes, you know, the scumbags. So, you know, one of the deals we worked on that was actually a compliant pre-funding token offering, you know, we did this big raise, and then you know, they brought on full-time GC. They went to the SEC to ask, well, do you think this, you know, the stable coin will fit an exemption? The SEC said no. The offer just returned the capital to investors, right? But now they're out of business, and you've got people like Block One with $13 billion in fraudulently raised assets. So that dichotomy needs to end. And, you know, it's not going to end unless the SEC gets serious about both guidance to do it legit, well, penalizing criminals, and not waiting 7 years like they did in Ripple and XRP to bring a suit.
That's terrific. Sam's asked a question that I think I'd like to throw out to the panel before we move on.
He said, I hope he's not yelling at me.
No. He says, isn't the big risk with digital assets what governments will do? And not just the SEC and the CFTC, Treasury, but China. I mean, China has now banned crypto for, I think, the fifth or sixth time. They seem to be serious about it this time, though. Sudden moves here and there. Isn't that really the big risk? I mean, I notice when I look at risk factors, it's always on the list, which is we can't predict what the government will do. But I mean, what do you all think about that?
I think if, as the only non-lawyer here, that, you know, some perspective, I think if you look at, let's say, over-the-counter derivatives had no legal certainty until the CFMA Act of 2000. Yet they were a multi-trillion dollar market. Yes. The internet army is an awful big army. I think the governments can try to stamp it out, but I think the technology is so compelling. It's just going to, all that's going to do is put hurdles up and make it more expensive to trade. But it's a computerized technology that's decentralized. It's here to stay and it's going to trade.
So can I trade, jump in? I think the problem, China, of course, is a non-democratic government. I think it's much harder for democratic governments to ban cryptocurrency. I can't imagine what would happen in Washington if Gensler had announced at a hearing we were banning cryptocurrency. And also with respect to China, so long as there are substantial countries that don't, it's not really going to affect the price. I mean, it hasn't affected the price of Bitcoin, for instance. Bitcoin, I think, is now higher than it was when China banned cryptocurrency.
Well, but I mean, governments do boneheaded things, though. I mean, the government of the United States banned liquor for a while, right? I mean, that didn't go very well, and there was a black market. So I suppose the government could ban it and create a black market
You can make the case, too, that fraud is being done with regular fiat currency right now. Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
I think fraud's a strong word. Rapid debasement and devaluation.
Well, the U.S. dollar has depreciated steadily for the last 100 years. So
that's right.
It's been the lowest yielding investment for sure over the last 100 years. Let's hear some more about about investment in this industry. Jeff, you're a professional investor as an angel and as a fund manager. You know, give us some of your experience in businesses that have issued and sold digital assets, have made markets and securities tokens. I think you're into insurtech and other fintech, you know, a little bit. What's the risk reward in this industry?
Just in general, like I'm the only non-lawyer on this panel. My daughter went to Northwestern Law. Professor McGinnis was probably her favorite professor there. I think it's been a tough investing climate. It's been a one-way street, sort of very volatile markets, but always higher. It's been speculation driven. When you look at ICOs that James touched on, very few of them have actually built anything. There's really no tangible products out there that people can use yet. Like when you think about the advent of the internet, the killer app was Netscape, the browser, the first browser. Mm-hmm. The Lightning Network I just saw was able to transfer 3,000 Bitcoin. Well, when you think about the networks that the credit card companies have, that's just minuscule. There's no real trading volume when you compare to other products. Where to invest? I think that's the best way to think about it. Like we know what the past is. We know what the detractors say or the fanboys say. In my case, I own some Filecoin. I own some Bitcoin. I own some Ethereum. I invested in Bitnomio, which is going to be, it's a launched futures exchange now. It's the only one in the world that actually physically delivers the cryptocurrency tokens on futures contracts. We'll see what happens with that. I invested in a company called Cover that uses blockchain technology. They reprogrammed the Ethereum token mm-hmm. to put pools of capital, insurance capital out on blockchains for discrete risk transfer and different things. They started out doing just phone screens, eventually became income insurance for Uber and Lyft drivers. And now they're doing return insurance. And they've done very well for us. I just invested in a company called ML Tech that's trying to democratize the research side of the hedge fund business to match up with pools of capital. James will be happy to know that they've relocated from Chicago to Miami because it's a great environment.
Let's go!
Down there. In Chicago here, I invested in Open Finance. They did an ICO. Pat was the attorney with that firm. They were the first company to make it through the SEC process where they could actually trade security tokens, which is different than regular commodity tokens. But because of the SEC sort of reticence to regulate actively here,
it took forever. It cost too much. Legal fees were too high.
Everything was too high. There was really no trading volume in it. They were bought by an Israeli exchange and the transaction is being consummated. I think when you think about like the future of this stuff, what to invest in, tangible stuff. So I love Filecoin because it's distributed. Mm-hmm. Cloud storage, it's going to be a competitor to Amazon. It's going to be a competitor to Microsoft. I love Helium because it can be distributed again and compete with cell networks. So those are actual tangible things. They're not live yet, but you could see, make a case for it. One thing that I think, you know, James touched on with NFTs, non-fungible tokens, and, you know, the art market or whatever being propped up. I think NFTs are going to be a gigantic thing. I think that corporations are starting to look at them, but I think they're going to be a big deal with tickets, with fraud, with provenance of art, with fraud prevention. And eventually, we have these constant voting debates in this country. I think eventually you're going to use NFT tokens to vote, to prove that you're actually a U.S. citizen and you reside where you reside. When I think about China cracking down, it's a typical Chinese thing. What they did early was they took all they could, they developed this industry, they learned all they could, and now they're cracking down so that they can issue a digital yuan. They're 27% of their hash power, the Bitcoin network. They were over 50% for a while. And I think my personal opinion is the US should never have a digital dollar. Because you can turn that money on and you can turn it off. And that's what the Chinese are going to do. It is a communist society. It isn't a free society at all. And so I think that's what they're going towards, is their digital yuan, and they're going to try to dominate that way, because they only care. I mean, they want world domination, but they care about controlling their people, and controlling the currency controls the people. So that's kind of where I stand on stuff.
On the municipal level, and here, this is from Joe Walters in Pennsylvania. He points out that Francis Suarez, Miami mayor, James's friend, my friend, have gone live with Miami Coin, and other cities are moving in this direction. What do you all think about that? You know, Miami Coin is used to fund what I'd call charitable and eleemosynary uses in Miami. James, do you have a perspective on that?
I wouldn't trade it, right? But basically, I look at it as it's part of the fantastic job, and I do mean this sincerely in a flattering sense, that Suarez has done as the hype man of Miami. Yes. And you know, he's really gone after businesses on both coasts and just the abusive tax policies of New York and California. And he's attracted some of the best and brightest entrepreneurs from the US, and has made us feel at home and built a community and actually like appreciates the jobs that we bring, other, you know, unlike the states that they're leaving. And I think that the coin is just another arrow in the quiver to say, you know, we're serious about being the crypto capital and we're going to continue to innovate. So, you know, go Suarez. I do, as I've told you before, I do think that he should really be pushing the Florida Bar Association for reciprocity. The Florida Bar is kind of a joke. And, you know, the restrictions they have in place for lawyers joining there, you know, it's really designed to keep out. But if they're serious about wanting to compete with Wyoming and in terms of, you know, state driven legislation, like they need a better bar there. Though you do have the in-house counsel exemption, like the, you know, I'm able to operate under there, but, you know, make it easier to attract talent. And guess what? You have a whole, you know, another industry moving there, the legal industry, right? Because, you know, yeah, a lot of us get taxed ordinary income plus self-employment tax. And, you know, you layer, you know, New York type city and state tax, you can hit 66% effective tax rate. So some reciprocity there, I think, would really help a lot of lawyers move, though some may not like that, you know, for
It's great to see a government official who is such an exponent for this industry, and I think we're going to hear a lot more of him. He's poised to become head of the National Council of Mayors, if assuming he's reelected in November, and I think he will be. I want to go to Matt Lyle, who's been patiently waiting. Matt really wears two hats. His day job is counsel to Galaxy Digital, which is famously Mike Novogratz's company, Mike and his team. And if you don't know him, that means you never watch Squawk Box. Fabulous company, traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange and with trading operations based here in Chicago. But that's his day job. At night, Matt runs the Global Digital Asset and Cryptocurrency Association, and what I'll call an aspiring SRO for this industry. And it's been very busy too. And I'll let you pick and choose what you want to talk about, Matt. Option A, option B, or something else altogether. But what would you like to say?
Well, thanks, Pat, for having me. I appreciate that. I just want to start out by saying that since you opened up this conference and talked about the price of Bitcoin, it went up to 55,200 plus, and now it's down at 54,967. So I think it is a volatile asset class.
Yes.
And you know, it's a fun asset class. The reason why I got into this space is I am a an old school, I guess, CFTC attorney that was involved in the regulatory compliance space in the Chicago markets here, both on the exchange side and the FCM side. And a couple of partners approached me and said, what do you think about starting up a business that would be lending on a secured basis against crypto? And I gave it, you know, about 4 seconds thought, and I jumped right in because the FCM business where I was with is kind of stagnant, and I'll call it a terrible business. This is an exciting time for me and in my career. I basically went back to square one in terms of learning what I needed to learn as an attorney. When you start in this industry, you realize very quickly that there's a whole heck of a lot of lack of clarity in from a legal standpoint, a regulatory standpoint in this space. We could certainly, and we have been talking about it in a number of different from a number of different perspectives. I am now with Galaxy Digital. Our business that we started, we were doing some pretty cool things from a trading's perspective, from our derivatives background, in terms of managing the crypto collateral with OTC derivatives. And then we ended up setting up some commodity pools. And I think it was because we were so creative and innovative in what we were doing, Galaxy got interested in our company and purchased the company late last year. So we are now with Galaxy Digital. We're sort of their Chicago operation. Galaxy also purchased a proprietary trading shop, Blue Fire Capital, at the same time. So they wanted to get a lot better and a lot deeper bench in derivatives. And that's certainly borne out. We've been able to expand that side of the business, and I think that it's crucial to it's one of the crucial pieces in terms of trying to put together what their aim is, which is a full service investment bank. There's probably others in the space that are trying to do this comprehensive prime broker / investment bank business model, and we're one of them, and we're fairly well along. And one of the things that people are aware of, if they've been paying attention to Galaxy, is the fact that we announced an intent to purchase BitGo, which, if all goes well, we should finish that up by the end of this year. And the purchase price on that is a $1 billion plus, which at the time, and actually it may still be the largest acquisition in this space to date. And what it does is it points to the importance of the fundamental, having a fundamental backbone if you're going to service customers in this space. And I should make the point that Galaxy is only facing institutional customers. It does not delve into the retail space, which is an entirely more risky animal in this day and age. So that's the background of Galaxy. We have a huge offering of different products and different businesses. And Mike Novogratz is an incredibly ambitious person and is trying to diversify the company as fast as possible. So that said, let me switch hats and talk about my night job, which is as chairman of the Global Digital Asset and Cryptocurrency Association, which arose in Chicago here about almost 2 years ago. And we were all of the opinion that there wasn't enough clarity in the space, and we scratched our chins and decided that what we needed to do is to bring in a self-regulatory solution to this space. So we have spent a great deal of time constructing the governance and the transparency of this organization. And then we launched probably last year about this time officially, and to date we have 40 members. So we've been spending most of our time kind of under the radar screen, so to speak. But we are now coming out in a big way. We've done a great deal in terms of starting up an advocacy operation, which is crucial with respect to getting legitimacy and credibility for a self-regulatory association. Let me just spend a couple of minutes talking about what the model of self-regulation is intended to be. We are not trying to be FINRA or NFA. Those models are mandated by Congress. They have definitely an objective. They serve those objectives as best they can. I'm going to leave aside for now, you know, whether or not those models actually work or are too much of a burden in the industry. But we know those models. One of the models you might not know if you're in this space is a model that the grain industry uses. It's run by the National Grain and Futures National Grain and Feed Association. They're a trade association that's based in Washington, D.C., and they've been around since 1896. And part of their mission is to drive a self-regulatory initiative in this space. One of the things that you could take note from this is the fact that there isn't really much active regulation around the spot grain markets. And a big part of that is because the National Grain and Feed Association, I think, does a very terrific, efficient job in managing its self-regulatory function. Simplistically, how it works is the industry, which is comprised of about 1,000 members here in the United States, gets together and through its members in a consensus driven process, comes together and puts forth what the trade rules are. And those trade rules govern all of the transactions in the commercial grain space in the United States. So every bushel of grain that is traded in the cash markets is usually done pursuant to the National Grain and Feed Association trade rules. Now, if there is a dispute about the trade rules and the application of those trade rules, those NGFA members are required under the rules of the association to arbitrate that dispute. That arbitration system is set up not like the AAA system, but a very streamlined commercial arbitration system instead. There is no discovery in the process. It's simply an arbitration on the pleadings. There's a couple of sets of pleadings, then an independent panel is appointed. It's a panel of three. There's a chair of the panel. They consider the pleadings. There is a right to have an oral argument, but it's rarely used. And then a decision is rendered that's in writing and published to the public that will provide the basis for the reward. So that's the kind of self-regulatory model that we are looking at here. One of the reasons is because obviously we don't have a legislative mandate, but we do believe that there is an issue here with respect to how quickly government and governments around the globe can get ahead of a technology and a marketplace that is moving this fast. You've got Moore's Law, I think, that's in effect here. The business, the marketplace is morphing at warp speed. It will be very difficult for regulators and Congress to get in front of this. It's very difficult to write a set of rules flexible enough to be able to handle all of the unforeseen developments in this space. So what we think is the solution is to impose a fairly high level regulatory structure on the industry and that accommodates or addresses all of the jurisdictional issues amongst all the agencies, but then allow self-regulation to sort of take root and provide sort of that on-the-ground expert input and then a consensus-driven process, which would then set industry standards with certainly some sort of accountability to regulators. So that's in a nutshell what we're trying to do with the GDCA. Again, I'll mention that we've already gotten 40 members, and I think we're going to be probably 50 members by the end of the year. Foley and Lardner, Pat's firm, is definitely a member. We're at this point, doing as well as we can. And like I said, we have started an advocacy operation that has included the comments to Senator Toomey's request for proposals on digital assets legislation. So we're certainly coming to the forefront and people's attention, and I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, Matt, there's a mouthful there. Let me go over a couple of those points with you and get some more context, if I would. Sure. Let's start with standard setting, because I know that the association is developing standards in a couple areas. Talk a little bit about that, what you've done and what some of the challenges are to create and implement standards on a voluntary basis among competitors and participants in an industry. How do you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Pat. And the answer is that you need to build credibility and you need to build a membership base. 40 members is not going to cut it, especially when you want to be global. But you have to start somewhere. And so, it's a step-by-step process. But what you're trying to do is pull in the serious thought leaders in the space to begin with, who will then lead the industry. We're also not going to bite off too much that we can't chew. So we are taking our time and picking through the most important types of standards that we think that we can get our arms around. That would include, technological standards, ISO type of things, yes, fixed type standards and those kinds of things. But to get into the meaty stuff, like what is a security and what isn't, or how should you be developing a protocol? Those are more along the lines of probably a best practice kind of an approach at this point. We certainly can probably delve into AML KYC, and we intend to put out some sort of best practices in that regard. But those are the kinds of things that we're going to start to offer our members.
The ISO standards, that's an advance too. That doesn't just happen by itself. Somebody needs to take the initiative and do that. And I know the association is doing that.
Yeah.
One would think that would... That could be very helpful. Also talk a little bit about the advocacy piece. I think you have had some personal engagement with Senator Toomey's staff on behalf of the association. He is someone who's sort of in the middle about what's going on Capitol Hill regarding crypto assets, and is in a position to be very influential, I think. Is there anything there you want to share with us from your...
Sure.
Recent encounter? Yes.
Thanks, Pat. So I mentioned that we responded to Senator Toomey's request for proposals and legislation. And so we submitted a fairly comprehensive response with several asks and suggestions. The first ask was to think about and consider imposing a general basic taxonomy in the industry, because we feel like that's the starting point for regulation. What do you call these assets? Are they securities? Are they payment tokens? Are they utility tokens? Let's be fairly simple. The second thing that we would like to see is the consideration and implementation, we hope, of a regulatory sandbox, which would provide a safe harbor, not unlike what Commissioner Peirce proposed a couple of years ago with respect to safe harbor from applicable regulations. This, I think, would give certain initiatives space to grow. but wouldn't be in a situation or in an environment where nothing, no regulation would apply. There would still have to be disclosures. So to go after James's concern, you know, you'd have to put out disclosures that are meaningful, that investors can get the full picture of what's going on. Because I will tell you, and Pat, I think you and I have had a number of discussions, it's very difficult to get all of the important, critical, crucial aspects of these protocols. They're coming in so fast, and there isn't probably as much attention as you'd like to see as a lawyer in terms of what are the aspects of these protocols, and more importantly, what is the expectation? You look at the Ethereum as the model, the Hinman speech, and I think that that's an effective model that, that we can base our decisions on. And there you have a protocol that was set up to be decentralized, but it begins life as a centralized activity. And that's almost required to set up one of these protocols because you need to raise the money in order to develop those. So why not be able to raise money within a safe harbor as long as you, at the end of time, get to a point where it is sufficiently decentralized? We can talk about the details there, but that's sort of the broad brush. The third thing we asked for is more clarity, obviously, around how regulations apply, specifically with respect to the delineations between the various different regulators. Fourthly, as I was just describing, we're asking for a accommodation for self-regulation in this space. And fifth, we asked for a little more clarity with respect to federal preemption of state regulation, because if anybody's been in this space, you understand that a lot of potential state licensing requirements apply, and those can take a while to get, as well as a lot of money and resources. So that's one of the many hurdles that you have to jump over in order to start up a business here. So I can go on and on about this, but if you have any specific questions, happy to answer.
Thanks for your report. And I think this is a sign of how far the industry has come, because there was no such association 3 years ago when we held this panel. And no, you don't have governmental power or imprimatur yet, and don't especially seek it. But the NFA grew up in Chicago in the commodities industry. FINRA grew up in the retail business in New York and Washington, D.C., from these sprouts, trees grow. So perhaps it will happen. We have about 3 or 4 minutes left. I want to turn the discussion a little bit to stablecoins, because I'm getting several questions from the audience about stablecoins. I'll mention it with reference to the current debate about the use of what I'll call FedCoin, a Federal Reserve accounts for individual citizens, which don't exist in the United States. Banks have accounts with the Fed, but individuals do not yet. That could change. Individuals could have accounts. And this could be done in connection with a digital stable coin that the government would issue. That raises a lot of questions in my mind. I'll toss a couple out and see what you think. One is that a good thing or a bad thing? Does anyone think it's dangerous for the government to have such a view of your personal finances as it would have with an individual account with the federal government? There are privacy concerns, it seems to me. That's one issue. Another is, what happens to private stablecoins if the government moves into this area? Does it squeeze them out intentionally, unintentionally? What do you all think about that? Maybe I'll start with Professor McGinnis. I don't know if you have any views on this, but...
Well, I do. Yes. I may not answer. I think there are other better experts on stablecoin than I am, but I make 2 points. One, I do think it's quite dangerous, because it would allow, as I think was mentioned before, the government to do all sorts of things with your money, create, including having negative interest rates and losing your money over time. I think those are really, and as well as also being a kind of panopticon, to use the Bentham's idea of having a government being able to see through all of your activities. There's a famous book called Seeing as a State, talking about how the government has a tendency to do that. So that's a real problem. On the other hand, I think people will be so, some people will be so worried about using this coin, particularly if it was the only kind of coin that it could be used for these reasons, it might actually give a boost to cryptocurrencies. In other words, it'd have this sort of boomerang effect. Mm-hmm. I've talked about cryptocurrency as ultimately a competitor. And insofar as they raise the cost of holding in personal terms, dollars, that's not very good for the dollar. So one of the things I like about cryptocurrency is it's an alternative to fiat currency and therefore is likely to keep it more honest. And so I think that's a real is going to be a real deterrent to do it. China can do it. They've already got a communist society, but I don't think, I think for us, it's a mistake. And the presence of cryptocurrency may deter this mistake.
And the communist regime wants to use this currency precisely so they can surveil their own people, which it gives me pause about it happening in the U.S. But one danger
that economists have uncovered about cryptocurrency and blockchain is we're very afraid of, let's say, monopolistic competition in the United States and things like that. We have legal things, definitions and laws and cases. You can get a situation where a blockchain can become dominant. And in effect, you have monopolistic lock-in on that blockchain where there's no way to get out because of the network effects associated with using that currency. And that's something we haven't talked about, which is probably a totally different topic, but a competitor, you need competition in the crypto space. And when the government comes in and issues their own coin, it will crush a lot of the competition, as Professor McGinnis said.
I see that. Well, we could talk all day about this. I think maybe we'll do it again, and maybe not 3 years from now. I want to adhere to our timeline and just ask if any of the panelists have anything they'd like to say in closing before we call it off. Dan, you've got all these things figured out, and you're going to tell us, you're going to report back eventually how they were all solved successfully in Capitol Hill. And Matt, thank you. James, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I can always weigh in, right? So, you know, I would just urge kind of everyone in this audience. I mean, the Federal Society has the reputation for standing up for the principles of limited government. And I think that all of us here in the audience need to do that. And when it comes for either, you know, pushing for malpractice for lawyers who don't follow the rules, or pushing back against fascist COVID-related rules, or FedCoin, which is the U.S.-based stable coin that would fully put us in a dystopian world with every transaction being tracked and taxation becoming automated on the blockchain. I think that all of us need to err on the side of speaking up rather than just passively accept it. Because the trend line that we're on right now is not a positive one, and I'm super disappointed that we weren't able to have this in person today because of, mass concerns and whatever. But, we need to go on with our lives and, get back to living and, stand up against a lot of the insanity that's going on in the world right now.
Thank you, James. I agreed all the way around. There's a request, Matt, that to see the comments delivered by the association to Senator Toomey. Could we maybe post those on the association's website, something like that, when time permits?
Yes, absolutely. We will be we'll publish and we'll probably do our press release. So
that's great. What is the website address for people who are interested and want to look?
It's global-dca.org.
Terrific. Well, Mr. Adams, I think we've completed our panel. I'm 3 minutes over, so you can chasten me for that. But I believe we're done. And if you have any final comments on behalf of the society, please feel free.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom on digital assets. I think we all learned a ton about this really interesting and novel topic that will be with us for quite some time. Zana, thank you for organizing this wonderful event. And the Federal Society, thank you for hosting us and allowing us to talk about these issues. Just want to put a plug in for three events that are coming up. And James, we are meeting in person next week. So perhaps you can come up from Miami.
We are meeting.
Not us, but the Federalist Society. We'll be hosting an event at the Ivy Room in Chicago called Public Trust and Private Rights in Chicago with Professor Nicole Garnett of Notre Dame and Professor Thomas Merrill of Columbia Law School to talk about a book that Professor Merrill just wrote about Chicago and public trust and private rights. In April of next year, the Federalist Society Chicago chapter is going to host the Midwestern Conference. Professor McGinnis will be one of our speakers. So if you enjoyed him today, you can hear him speak about the First Amendment and other issues surrounding themes on Abraham Lincoln. We're going to be doing it at the Lincoln Library in Springfield. Once again, that's the third weekend in April. And then just a few weeks afterwards, with the tremendous assistance of Patrick and other folks, we're going to be hosting the first annual in-house council symposium for the Federalist Society in Chicago at the Union League Club on Saturday, May 14th, with keynote address from General Bill Barr to talk about what's going on in corporate America and in-house council world. Thank you, everybody, for your time. Thank you for your participation, and I hope to see you sometime soon. Take care.